Some blame it on the pill, others on the breakdown of traditional values among the nation's youth. The change was so dramatic that it was called the sexual revolution. But just how revolutionary was it, and what brought it about? We shall see. That's the subject of this week's conversation between Talking History's Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska, and his guest, Beth Bailey.
The sexual revolution seemed to burst upon America in the 1960s. A sudden rejection of traditional morality by cultural radicals. But according to my guest, Beth Bailey, the profound changes associated with the sexual revolution sometimes came gradually, their roots extending back to the 1940s and 1950s. These transformations were often wrought by ordinary Americans in ordinary places. And while the sexual revolution was certainly about sex, it was often about much more. Beth Bailey is a professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico and the author of Sex in the Heartland, which focuses on the post-war evolution of sexual attitudes and practices in a single Midwestern city, Lawrence, Kansas. Professor Bailey, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you've written a book about sex in the heartland. Why not sex in the city?
And you don't know how many times I've told people that I was working on sex in Kansas and they thought I was telling a joke. That's really why I wanted to write about sex in Kansas instead of sex in the city, because there's a real sense of Kansas as being out of the mainstream. How many times do you hear that phrase, you're not in Kansas anymore? And I picked Kansas because it seemed really to be the opposite of New York. So many people treat it as, in the public imagination, the antithesis of bicoastal sophistication. So my sense was that if I could show the changes that were taking place in Kansas instead of in places like New York and San Francisco, that where there have always been groups that didn't really live in accord with the conventional rules about sex, I could show that there really was more of a revolution. When I was doing the research for this book, I heard a story many times from different people in Lawrence, Kansas, about Ed Sanders, who was one of the real heroes of the counterculture, who lived in New York and was part of the band The Thugs and edited a poetry magazine, I guess, whose name I can't really say on the radio these days still. And he had come to Lawrence because he was interested in the poetry scene and was walking down the street one night and ran into a man there in Lawrence walking down the street completely naked. And the way they tell the story in Lawrence is that Ed Sanders talked to this man in Lawrence for a little while, and then they both went on their way, and Sanders said, well, Lordy, the revolution's come, because this is happening in Lawrence, Kansas, and not just in major centers of the country.
Now, Sanders is walking down the streets of Lawrence, Kansas in, what, the late 1960s?
Mid-1960s, yeah.
What kinds of things prepared Lawrence for the revolution that he thought he saw? What had gone on in the 40s and 50s, for example, to pave the way for those changes?
There are really two sets of changes that I'm tracing in the book, and one of them is the more conventional story that we already know. The kinds of things that Alfred Kinsey found in his studies of sexuality in America in the late 1940s and early 1950s, that the ways that people behaved didn't necessarily correspond with the rules that existed in the culture. So when Kinsey was looking at behavior in the U.S. in this period, he discovered that, you know, more than 80% of women in his sample disapproved of premarital sex, but more than 50% of them had premarital sex. He discovered that 30-something percent of American men had some kind of experience of homosexuality in their lifetime. Now, historians have increasingly found problems with Kinsey's sample, with his methods, with the ways he was conducting his research, but those kinds of issues still really do hold. The way people were behaving across the 20th century didn't necessarily correspond with what they said they did or with what the rules were, and you know, that's a part of it, the way in which what he called the overt culture didn't match the covert culture. People were having sex before the sexual revolution in ways they weren't supposed to be doing so, though what's interesting is that the way a lot of them counted what sex was has a lot to do with the way that President Clinton counted what's real sex and what isn't. It's the kind of tortured definition where the missionary position becomes, in some senses, the final frontier. So one set of changes that was taking place is the way that what people were doing was changing gradually, and that people start to come to terms with that by the 1960s. But the more unusual argument I'm trying to make in this book is that the origins of the sexual revolution in many times lie in places that had really very little to do directly with sex, or certainly weren't intended to enable a revolution in sex. The creation of an interstate highway system, certainly nobody went before Congress and argued that we needed to fund interstate highway system to enable a sexual revolution. But what's happening in the period after World War II is a process of nationalization, where the nation is being tied more closely together. And that means that local elites and local communities in many ways have less control over the boundaries of their community and over what rules and customs prevail in those communities. In Lawrence, for example, right after the war, there was a concerted move by some of the local elites to try and pull the town back into what they saw as proper morality after some of the disruptions of the war. And one of the main things they wanted to do was to shut down the bars that had grown up where you could go and drink and dance, because they thought that having drink and dancing in the same place was an occasion for sexual immorality more often than not. And they had statistics to back them up from all sorts of federal agencies that had studied wartime behavior. So they made an ordinance that said you can't drink and dance in the same place. So all of the patrons said, fine, we'll go to Topeka, we'll go to Kansas City, we'll leave. And the business people in Lawrence finally forced them to change the law back, because it was easier. More people had cars, there were better roads, it was easier to go other places. It was hard to draw the lines around the community. Same thing happened with literature that had to do with sexuality. All sorts of places where the boundaries were more permeable and the control was less complete.
Another change, it's a medical one that occurs in the early 60s, is the introduction of the pill. It's a medical breakthrough. But as you've already mentioned, there were attitudes. I think you quote one survey in your book that 80 or 90% of college students consider premarital sex immoral, which raises the question, notwithstanding the medical breakthrough, what kinds of changes in attitudes were necessary for these unmarried women to want to use the medical breakthrough?
Those statistics are always so complicated, because what I found at the University of Kansas in the mid-60s is something around 98% of senior women saying that they disapproved of premarital sex, but it's really, really, really unlikely that 98% of them were virgins at that point, especially because the number of them on the pill, according to the medical statistics there, was really, really high. So people often, one of the things that happened in the sexual revolution is people starting to admit to what they were actually doing, and it was becoming more acceptable. With the pill, a lot of the works you read about the 60s in general sort of say, and then there was the pill, and it caused the sexual revolution. And it just doesn't work that way, because as it is today, you couldn't get the pill on the free market. It didn't just appear. You had to have it prescribed by a doctor. And throughout the nation, the medical profession was very hesitant to prescribe pills for unmarried women. That right wasn't guaranteed by the Supreme Court until in the 1970s. People certainly did things like buy gold rings at drugstores and get fitted for diaphragms or get the pill, but it wasn't readily available because most physicians, like most Americans, didn't believe that unmarried women had any business having contraceptives. And there was a huge debate about whether making them available to college women would increase promiscuity, as it was put at the time. So there was a dual set of changes. Part of it was young people feeling like they could go and ask for the pill without their reputation being ruined. And part of it was the medical profession being willing to prescribe it. I found a story in Kansas City of a woman going to a doctor there, and before he would give her the pill, he gave her a long lecture about how it would make men think that she was sexually available, and told her the story of a woman getting beaten up for not having sex with a man who knew she was on the pill, as if that were one of the medical side effects that one might encounter. The reason the pill became available to unmarried women was really not so much because of concern about protecting them in sex, but because of a concern about the population growth problem. people during this era were immensely concerned in the field of public health about the worldwide population growth. And in the U.S., unfortunately, that was often tied to concerns about the growth of a welfare state and money being paid to unmarried women and their children. And so there was a move within the public health business, the public health field, to make the pill more available as a way of stemming the public health problems of unbridled population growth. And in many ways, unmarried women came in through the side door. And Lawrence, the physician who ran the public health service there, was immensely involved in zero population growth and these problems. He thought it was the biggest problem that faced the world. And he was handing out the pill by the armful to young women who came in and telling them to give it to all their friends.
Probably few people today remember Linda LeClaire, but she achieved a kind of national fame, I guess actually infamy is a better word, back in 1968. Could you remind us of who she was?
Sometimes I hate to be contributing to Linda LeClaire's continued infamy because I'm sure she doesn't appreciate it. Linda LeClaire was a young woman who was enrolled at Barnard College in the mid to late 1960s who was living off campus with her boyfriend who was a student at Columbia. And Barnard, like most places in the country, had very strict rules about how young women were supposed to behave themselves and curfews and such. And the way she got away with living off campus was by filling out forms that said she was living as a live-in domestic helper in someone else's home, when in fact that was a friend and she wasn't. She was living with her boyfriend. And she got caught. What happened is that the New York Times decided to do a feature article about the new practice, as they put it, of living together. And they interviewed some couples around the city. And even though Linda LeClaire used a pseudonym, she used enough of specifics about herself and her school that it was really not so hard for the Barnard administration to figure out who she was. And she got very quickly called on the carpet for this. She got in trouble officially for lying about where she was living rather than for living with a man, but it became a huge issue around the country. And what's really funny about this is that this is the same spring that Columbia was being occupied, that the entire nation was in uproar, and half of the headlines that you found in New York during that spring seemed to be about Linda LeClaire living with a man. She was called horrible things in newspapers around the country. I've been through the cache of letters at Barnard, and the word that shows up most really is alley cat. There's a real sense of the fact that she was living with a man. It became a huge, huge national issue, and she was roundly criticized, and calls were flooding in that she should be expelled, etc. What eventually happened is that the Barnard Disciplinary Committee did not expel her, but they barred her from the student cafeteria, which is a kind of perhaps not terrible punishment for those of us who have eaten in college cafeterias in the past. But it reflected that sense, in some senses, that sexuality is contagious and that young women who are sexually active should be somehow quarantined from other young women because it might spread. But the fact that this could be an amazing struggle and crisis in national culture in 1968, the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated, that Robert Kennedy was assassinated, that there were tanks in the streets of Chicago, tells us something about how sexual culture has changed over these years.
What's the legacy of the sexual revolution after all these years?
I'm more optimistic about the legacy of the sexual revolution than many. And it's not because I think that we're without problems in our sexual lives today. But I look back as a historian, and I see so many tragedies from the previous systems of young women whose lives were ruined in many ways because they transgressed against the sexual norms, women who were considered spoiled, of homosexuality being so much not accepted that young men, especially, who were discovered in consensual sexual relationships with other men could be put in jail or expelled from school. Not having that happen is an important legacy of the sexual revolution. It's a good legacy. The other thing that I see as important is that we have more debates today about what's appropriate. There are more choices. also talk about what works and why. It's possible for young people to decide that they want to remain virgins until marriage. It's possible for young people to live together. It's possible for people to have dates or other kinds of hanging out, hooking up in ways that are more gender equal. That's a good thing. And I think that one of the main legacies of the sexual revolution I see is the ways it's interacted with changes in women's roles. The rules about sex in the previous part of the 20th century were very much a double standard. They were based on the notion that women had to control and limit sex and that men were supposed to be the aggressors. People behaved in different ways, but they all felt the weight of that system of prescriptions and rules. And we still have some double standard today, but it's not nearly as fierce. And there's a great deal more assumption that men and women in heterosexual relationships go into this in a greater position of equality, and that their relationships are based more on gender equality, and that has an effect on the kind of sexual relationships they have as well. Because the sexual revolution wasn't just about who has sex with whom, when, and how often. It was also about the way we organize our long-term relationships and the relationships between men and women in society.
Well, Professor Bailey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
I've been visiting with Beth Bailey, the author of Sex in the Heartland.